Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, yes, they did. They absolutely got it right here on Liberty Works Radio Network. And this is Tom Navolas, your host. And we have a lot to cover today. There's so many things that we talked about last week. I didn't make all the notes that I wanted to. But one of the things that I did mention is that let's kind of throw on my theological hat. And we're going to start with that, but I want to preface everything from the perspective in that when I think about what it means to drive all of this and bring it all circular around is definitely from Samuel Adams' perspective to start with. And I need to bring you up a little bit on that history before I get into and what we're going to cover in this first segment by no means takes and gets to the real, all the meat that we're going to cover. But let's do it this way. So Sam Adams, as many of you know, he went to Harvard at the age of 14. He already knew how to read and even write Latin. He knew how to read Greek. He had some understanding of Hebrew. And so it was very, very interesting as to what he knew from those ancient languages. And that was all in preparation to go to Harvard, because at that time, his parents did want him to become a minister. And many of you know that when I do my presentations of Samuel Adams, I talk about that, or in other lectures where I bring out that whole perspective that Sam Adams started out at Harvard for an honorable profession, and that being a minister, because that was considered an honorable profession even at that time, relative to whether or not it meant anything around ministering God's word, which it really, really did. I mean, face it, at that period in American history is that ministers actually preached the gospel still from that Reformation perspective. They were already, historically, we look at it, they were becoming tainted in so many ways, and that's what happened to Harvard, that's what happened to many of the universities, is they became tainted with the Enlightenment, and especially, which breaks my heart most, because I love what happened in the Reformation, especially in Scotland, is that the Scottish Enlightenment began to really destroy the great fundamentals of what was happening from the Reformation, and began to weave in the philosophies of man to the extent that true biblical perspective and concepts were being watered down, So when we think about how it was being watered down during the foundation of the nation to where it is today, there's very, very few churches that actually teach Reformation truth, that are Reformed churches, whether they're Reformed Presbyterian or Reformed Baptist. The one that really breaks my heart is that there's no Reformed Congregationalist out there anymore. Sam Adams fundamentally was a Congregationalist, but that derived as a form of government in the church relative to Puritan ideas and beliefs. So as many of you know, and it's on the website, SamuelAdamsReturns.com, is that Sam Adams was known, and one of his monikers is the Last Puritan. Now, that wasn't just because of the way that he dressed, that was because of what he believed theologically. And Sam Adams, what he did is he went in there and he was studying for the ministry. But at a period of time, and quite frankly, when Whitfield came through and preached, and he preached at Harvard, Adams heard him preach at Harvard, and it made a significant difference into where he recognized that salvation message of Christ was when Whitfield came in and ministered at Harvard. Now, with that, in addition, what happened was that he, in studying Scripture, in studying Calvin, and studying Althusius, and studying the other reformers, especially Knox and the other Scottish reformers, what he saw and what you can derive from his writings are what were in especially, say, Knox Appellation, which I did a whole program on Scott's, on John Knox Appellation, and then also in taking and studying Calvin. So that's where I want to take us in this first segment from that theological perspective. There are many, many pastors out there, even Reformed pastors, that will speak of Calvin. And in my opinion, again, I'm not a great theologian or a pastor, but I, you know, in reading and studying these foundational writers, studying the Reformers, I have to look at a number of pastors may knowingly or unknowingly misrepresent Romans 13 and what that means, and even misrepresent or only use portions of what even Calvin said in their messages that do not take in the whole picture. Of course, where you have to go on this is that Calvin wrote significantly about government. He did it not only in the Institutes, which we're going to briefly talk about today in Book 4, Chapter 20 in particular, and we're just, again, within the next 10 minutes, 8 minutes or so of what we have in this first segment, is that establishing that very, very, very fundamental, I am going to be guilty, and I'm going to admit my guilt, is that I am only going to touch on some reference points in Calvin that are specific to a point that I'm trying to get across. And so I'm telling you up front that I'm guilty of doing that, which so many pastors do, but they don't tell their congregation that they're only taking snippets, because there's this thing that I was reading about a ship out to sea, and it's got a hole in the side of the ship, and the ship is sinking. But all the officers on the ship are telling the people that the ship is okay, and there's only a few people that recognize that the ship is sinking and telling people to go on the lifeboats, but they don't believe the people to go on the lifeboat because the people on the ship that are the ship's officers are all in white, and they're certified and so on and so forth, that, you know what, they're the ones that are believable because they got their certifications and credentials. That's a very interesting analogy or allegory, if you will. So what happens is that many pastors, they just weave in stuff because the name Calvin, especially in the Reform movement or in the general Protestant environment that looks at Calvin for what he has to say, you know, wow, that's it. All you got to do is say Calvin, and any little snippet means something within the context of whatever a pastor may do. Fine. Well, I can't do that. I'm going to tell you right now what I am doing is that just from the beginning in chapter 20, and I can't get anywhere in this whole thing, is that he outlines the whole idea of civil government. But he outlines it from the perspective that we are living in a dual environment. We do have dual citizenship, and that's my way of saying it, is that first and foremost, the church is absolutely unequivocally set aside as that special agent of God within the world, period. There's no question about that. I mean, he is very, very clear throughout the whole Institutes on that. But yet, at the same time, he says we live in the world and that civil government is also instituted by God. Most pastors agree with that. They will say that. But what he does here, and where I want to jump ahead, if you will, because he covers that in the first, second, and I think, you know, somewhat of the third section of where he is in chapter 20 in talking about outlining that. And I encourage you, and I'll give you a link to the Institutes, and you need to go pull them down. They're a PDF. You're going to have to download it, or go find chapter 20, book 4 in the Institutes and read it for yourself. Study it for yourself, because what we end up having here is that he talks about this in that what it is and having established that whole idea. And one thing I want to quote here is very interesting right in the first section is that I have properly connected them, that being the spiritual aspect as well as the civil institutions and what that means. And in doing that, he says that I am under the necessity of doing so, especially while, on the one hand, frantic and barbarous men are furiously endeavoring to overturn the order established by God, and on the other hand, flatterers of princes extolling their power without measure hesitate not to oppose it to the government of God. Unless we meet both extremes, the purity of the faith will perish. We may add that into a small degree concerns us to know how kindly God has here consulted for the human race, that pious zeal may be more strongly urge us to testify of our gratitude. Then he goes on talking about the promise of the gospel, liberty, which is through Christ. And then he develops more that whole idea of making sure that we understand clearly that differentiation between God's purposes for the church. And then he talks about civil government as it is instituted. Now, he gets in there and he talks about a lot of things that pastors end up focusing on is way later in this chapter, is that, yes, we are, and he highlights it. And I'm just going to highlight these things. I can't read it all to you. We just don't have time. But he highlights that Christians, you know, we need to participate. We need to come under that authority that is given to us by God. But more so, what he covers in like sections 3, 4, 5, and so on, is that the leaderships, and he even talks about what he sees as a preferred form of government, and that there are three components of government, that being the leadership, the kings, then also the law, and which we're going to be talking about in the next two segments, is the law and the judiciary system in the Constitution. And then also what he talks about is the people as participants within that. So the key thing that I want to leave you with in these last couple of minutes is that what Calvin really stresses is that the purpose of government is to ensure that the gospel is held secure, that the truth of it is not perverted. He goes on to even talking about that, and I don't know that I'm going to have time to find that reference, and I didn't mark it especially, is that the duties of government is, that this, I say, is not its only object, in that, let me come back to that, it's not merely those things that enable men to breathe, eat, and drink, and be warm, but it is also that no idolatry, no blasphemy against the name of God, no calumnies against his truth, nor other offenses to religion break out and be disseminated among the people, that the public quiet be not disturbed, that every man's property is kept secure, that men may carry on innocent commerce with each other, that honesty and modesty be cultivated, in short, that a public form of religion may exist among Christians and humanity among men. So that's what he established as the purpose of government, according to God's word, according to the very biblical sense of what the purpose of government is. It's not just to make sure that people can eat and drink and be warm, but it is also to take care of how it is for a moral established. And as I said last week, and as Sam Adams talked about, and others also, the founders talked about, is that all government is religious. And where they got that principle from is right here out of Calvin's Institutes, is that all government is religious. And so we now have the religion of humanism instead of Christianity in the United States, which our Constitution cannot operate under. So we can get more into all of this conversation at another point in time. As I said, I'm going to try and bring some of these things forward, but at the same time, what we're going to do in the next two segments when we come back is talk about what it is on the judiciary and how this applies. So come on back in the next segment when Samuel Adams returns, those anti-federalists, they did They absolutely got it correct here on Liberty Works Radio Network. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the second segment of Samuel Adams Returns, Those Anti-Federalists, They Got It Right. And, you know, in the first segment, we covered a little bit out of Calvin's Institute, Book 4, Chapter 20. So much to go over. I wish I had time and opportunity just to take you through the lessons of that alone, and even what he did in writing to the Holy Roman Emperor of the day, because of the way that the impositions of government and what it was doing relative to trying to wipe out everything that was going on with the Reformation, because he had the alliance with the Pope, and the Pope didn't like the Reformation, so the idea was to wipe it out. But, you know, that's a whole nother story. But here on Liberty Works Radio Network, as you know, there is that blend of people that talk about constitutionalism as well as people that talk biblical, theological, church ideas. I would definitely challenge you to take and look at other hosts and hostesses on the network and support the network. It's very, very important. I appreciate everything that the network does for me, and I ask that you would support them. I would also ask that you would take and you would go to LibertyWorksRadioNetwork.com or LWRN.net and hit that support button and, you know, do what you can to help the network out. So what we're going to jump into, because like I said, there's a lot of different things. Now, I'm very, very clear and have always been very, very clear that as Sam Adams, I am very reformed-minded, reformation-minded, and from the original perspectives and concepts of the reformers, including Calvin, and then including Althusius, and then looking at all of the deviations that were happening during that period of time, trying to understand those historical perspectives of what does it mean for liberty first in Christ through the gospel in the whole essence, the whole, and this is the picture that I want you to grab as we move into what we're going to talk constitutionally, is that if you don't understand the whole Bible from Genesis to Revelations, I challenge you to find a church that preaches that from the historical reformed perspective, and that you gather that from that whole biblical historical perspective. Anyway, I could go on and on about that, but we'll kind of leave it right there, because I think it's critical that what we need to do right now is that we need to move through and look at some of the things that I left off somewhat last week, but I wanted to touch on again as we look at all of the arguments and insanity relative to this new pick for the Supreme Court. There's a lot there. And quite frankly, I can understand the arguments even from the Democrats and all of those other liberal positions. Because let's start from that perspective and premise, okay, that Sam Adams talks about, is that both all government and all education is religious. So if we know that over the last, say, 50 to 80 years, especially, let's say, over the last 45 to 50 years, when education was taken out of the schools, I mean, excuse me, education has been taken out of the schools, but when the Bible and prayer were taken out of the public schools, and we can even go back into the 30s and 40s with that, let alone what happened in the 60s, but when we look at that alone, we see that morality is gone. All of those things, all of the perspectives, all of that which is to be preserved in government is removed from education. There is no way that it can be fostered or protected in government itself. So when I started looking at Hamilton and what he wrote in Federalist 78 through 81, which, you know, again, I'm only going to be able to give you the tidbits on. You're going to have to read 78 through 81 on your own. And then what we're going to do is we're going to bring that back from Brutus and the Anti-Federalist perspective, which you've heard me, you know, talk about on this program many, many times, is that the contrast on what Calvin just talked about in those people who take, and what I said in the first segment that Calvin talked about, is that those people that are either, let me slide back up there real quick because I wasn't prepared to, it's kind of doing a flow thing. I didn't put all my notes together in any succinct manner, is that what he was talking about on the one hand, with frantic and barbarous men are furiously endeavoring to overturn the order established by God. And then on the other hand, you have flatterers of princes extolling their power without measure, hesitate not to oppose it to the government of God. So if we understand that all good government is established by God, and we understand that all those that reach higher levels of offices are ordained by God, and we understand that all those that we elect are already predetermined by God, there's a lot there that we have to, you know, take into account. And when we take that into account, and this is the important part, one of the things that Calvin did talk about is that, you know, every nation has a different form of government, that is all established by God. And yet within the scope and framework of that government, the people, you know, need to work within that perspective because God ordained that government for that country, okay? And, you know, people have to look and determine, and he says, you know, sometimes it's frivolous to go looking outside of that arena of the established government for the purposes upon which you're looking to, except, and this is where a lot of preachers get it wrong, except in the perspective of tyranny and despotism that is upon the people. Then the people have the absolute right to preserve God's good order, and in preserving God's good order for good governance, they have a right to take and bring God's good order and governance to forbearance, to bring that forward. Okay, that's a whole different lesson in talking about that. So when we look at our form of government, what we have and what came about through the process, and this is interesting in the process that when we did determine the tyrannies and all that was happening in Great Britain and the destruction and the religious liberties as much as anything else that were being stepped all over by the despotism of what was happening out of the king, then what we have established is a new government. And under those new governments, those new states, each colony becoming its own state, then they came together under the Articles of Confederation. Now, the Articles of Confederation were there because each individual state was preserving under its own constitution those things which Calvin talked about. They were independent nations, okay? And that's what we have to really, really understand. But under the Constitution that came out in 1787, we were moving to that consolidated government. And that's what Hamilton was huge about. And that is why the New York delegation left, was they were seeing this, you know, great united government that had potentials of despotism and tyranny, even at the judiciary, coming about. That's why Yates pulled the delegation out. There were other things that others said they weren't going to participate in, or why they did not sign and why they argued against. But let's get to the nut of today. Today, I wanted to get back to the judiciary, because as we look at it, and I started thinking about all of the battle that's going on about this Judge Kavanaugh and bringing him in and on as a justice, I said, okay, what is it about the Supreme Court? What is it about the judiciary under the Constitution? And as I mentioned to you, a good read is Dave Welty's book. I think I have it up here sitting on top of the Founders' Constitution over here. Is The Unfaithful Guardians, which is the play on Hamilton just opens up in 79, says that what? That the judiciary, being independent, is going to be a faithful guardian of the Constitution, and that they would be the least impactful to what happens in government. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say that after reading and rereading this past week and trying to just, you know, clear my mind on the arguments that Hamilton is making in 79 through 81 in particular, I mean, that's a lot. That's 79, you know, yeah, well, no, I'm sorry. It even goes back, yes, 76, I think. Let me see, where am I here? Golly day. Well, I'm looking at 80 here. But if you go 78, 79, 80, 81 and 82, I mean, holy smokes, you know, he's basically got five articles that he writes about the judiciary. As I wove my way through each one of those various articles, I saw where Yates then comes back and argues differently. I see where Hamilton is taking his position, and you have to remember that Hamilton was very, very much for more of an aristocratic, if not a kingship, if not a fully consolidated government, you know, doing away with the individual states. He saw this giant united government, and that was part of Hamilton's mentality when you really start driving in on his thought processes and what he was saying. So when we look at the judiciary then, as he explains it in the Federalist Papers, what we see is that he actually, in his arguments, begins to outline what we have in the judiciary today, his expectation that the judiciary would not be as impactful, but yet he outlines different things and says, if this occurs, then the judiciary, blah, blah, blah. He talks about the whole, and there's a lot of blah, blah, blah in there, so excuse me on that one. But what he talks about is that the judiciary has all of these perspectives over and above even the state judiciary. Wow. So this is the concern, that what we have are these sovereign states, but as a nation, that, and under the various clauses of the Constitution, what we see is that the federal judiciary, under making things equitable across the various states, as we go through those other articles, the judiciary has the capacity to look at that from the federal perspective, and that grant of equality for the citizenry. So this is the whole thing on citizenry. Are you a citizen of the state of Ohio, of Maryland, of your individual state, or are you a citizen of the United States? Well, you're both. But in that dual citizenship, the precedent that became different and where Hamilton took it was that equitable clause, if you will, would have precedent over everything else within the states. So you're starting to consolidate things. The other thing that we're going to get into in the next segment is where Hamilton starts talking about, when we're looking at treaties, when we're looking at international components and international interactions, that the Supreme Court actually, according to Hamilton, has that jurisdiction over how those are implemented. And we'll get into that, because I told you, and I tell you in the seminar, that Article 6 is very, very important, that what? Treaties become part, not of the Constitution, but the law of the land. And so in becoming a part of the law, therefore, the Supreme Court as a judicial body and all those courts that are subservient or subjected to it have those readings. And that becomes very interesting of what we're seeing in the lower courts relative to what happened with Donald Trump here at Samuel Adams Returns. Yes, they did. Those anti-federalists, they got it right. See you in the next segment. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this last segment of Samuel Adams Returns. The anti-federalist absolutely got it right here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty does work for you. And I try to bring all of those perspectives of history, both from that fundamental Reformation historical perspective as I read it and study it, as well as from the founders and framers' perspective, which includes those that became the Federalists and those who are known as the Anti-Federalists. And I always say the Anti-Federalists, they absolutely got it right. They absolutely did, because they were predictive. And as we closed out the last segment, we were talking about Hamilton's view relative to the judiciary. And where I left off with and at was, you know, what happened in the lower courts regarding some of the actions, executive orders, those actions that the president legally can take as the administrator of the law. And also what I was starting to talk about, how did that come into any question and idea relative to Article 6 of the Constitution? First off, I have to tell you that there is no possible way that I can bring you these points and ideas that I have from all of this source material. We are so ignorant to it, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, and those that listen to this network, because it's not taught in our schools, it's not taught in the universities, it's barely taught anywhere in law school, and it's absolutely not a part of that added curriculum that I believe should be within the context of the churches as it was at the beginning of the nation. Once again, let me go back to segment one and say that there is a differentiation as to what the Church of God is supposed to be doing, without question. But at the same time, what I look at, and as I look at Calvin, when there's a deficiency in what is happening in civil government, as we see throughout the whole Bible, prophets, and even Jesus himself, is that the civil government needs to be held accountable, and that the truths and applications of God's principles need to be injected into civil government. And if it has to be, it has to be by people within the context of the church. So I always tell those that, you know what, I don't believe the church needs to be teaching about civil government. But what they need to do is know those trusted people and make those trusted people available within the context of the church so that people can learn and understand, because they're not getting it out there, especially in these modern times, are not getting it out there in the general forms of education or even from the political sphere itself. So with that, I wanted to continue on. In that Article 6, and what we saw happen and had to go to the Supreme Court in particular, was not just the ideology of judges around what Trump did in his travel ban, as it was called, his executive order that was limiting immigration into the United States for reasons of safety, well within the scope of what he has to do administratively in carrying out the laws that are in effect. What the judiciary actually did is take a Hamiltonian principle and execute it. Because when you read Hamilton, and I'm referring to some of what Hamilton was talking about in Federalist 80, is that that is where he takes and he talks about what is going on relative to state laws, the authority of the federal court to overrule such as might mean in the contravention of the Articles of the Union, and also where he talks about the areas that are from an international basis. And what does that mean? And how does that affect the Union? And the Union being the union of the states in general under the new Constitution. So some of the things that he brings to bear in that is that he definitely talks about it in 80 and 81, is that what we have going on is this creature that the president and the Senate have full authority to exercise and is necessary is treaty. And in Article 6, what does it say? Article 6 says that treaties become what? A part of the supreme law of the land. They do not change the Constitution, but they are law. Therefore, according to Hamilton, the judges have, and the courts, and those courts established by the legislature under the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, have then the authority acting as subservient or as that subjugated or as that lower court status is taking and looking at then what is going on from that international treaty perspective. So when you have justices like Justice Ginsburg, who definitely sees that international law is, in some senses, in her own words, and I will paraphrase, is that the international law has more meaning and greater than our Constitution, then what you have is that potentials of the ideology that in those judges that have those different ideologies in the lower courts will be open to those groups which Calvin actually calls subversive. Isn't that interesting? He calls them subversive. So let me mix that in a little bit once again. So I apologize that I have no time or capacity here to take you through those correlations of what is happening in law from our Constitution, which according to what Calvin would teach is our form of government, and those ideologies that have been searching elsewhere in taking and looking at making changes by whatever means are subversive. So we have anarchists, which he talks about, and we have subversives to the Constitution. And when we have ideologies then that are in the judicial system, and what Hamilton talks about with the potentials of the judiciary, and he lays out the potentials of the judiciary to look at things differently, and that they have a right and a capacity to judge even at those international components. Ladies and gentlemen, what we have is that ideological judges can definitely take and utilize treaty and those international laws that we have subscribed to and have become law under treaty or international executive agreements, that's all part of the law component by which they have to take and which they have the right to take. They don't have to, but what the judiciary then has the right to take and look at relative to implementation. Now, the judiciary in the United States has far overstepped anything even Hamilton has ever talked about. They have gone down the path that Hamilton, I say, without warning, actually warned about. Whereas Yeats was very, very clear in the writings as Brutus as to what the court would and could become. And that is not even touching on what Thomas Jefferson talked about the court, but let's stay with the Anti-Federalists in and of themselves and what Brutus warned. So what we have is a court that can become subversive and tyrannical because of its jurisdictional capacities within the framework of the Constitution and the explanations that are often used by the Federalist Hamilton. And that is why the Anti-Federalists were very argumentative and expected that they would have a voice in determining the interpretation of the Constitution, both at a legal, at the legislative, and at the legal being the judicial perspective within the context of moving the Constitution forward and of the various states taking and doing what? Saying, yeah, we're going to even change our state constitution so that the federal constitution, we can fit into it. Remember, a lot of that had to happen. So as we continue down the discussion, which, you know, I can't get into reading this all because there's so much there, you need to go read the Federalist Papers and you need to read Brutus to get a clear understanding of the court. So in the arguments on who is Judge Kavanaugh, I don't know. You know, I don't have the time to read his all of his 3,000 documents that now they're trying to, you know, find and read, and all of his 300 and some odd judicial commentaries and decisions. But I would have to ask you to find the critical ones and, you know, don't piecemeal the things. You know, we have to look at it. But more importantly, I would suggest to you that what you need to do when we look at how is the Constitution viewed from that judicial perspective, that you go read Hamilton and what he has to say in those various chapters of the Federalist Papers. Because quite frankly, they're scary. They're really, really scary in that he leaves the door for the judiciary to become everything that it is. His expectation as a faithful guardian of the Constitution, the man really believed it. But at the same time, with what he was ascribing and saying that the Constitution gave the courts the authority to do, and this is without reading all of the commentaries that I would normally refer to, or going back into the Founders' Constitution that do all the correlations on all of that information for us. Just in reading Hamilton alone, I understand why Brutus came out as he did. I understand very, very clearly that the judiciary could become that really that branch of government that would be subversive and tyrannical, that would begin to take and determine its own form of law by virtue of how it adjudicated a case. And being the Supreme Court, it has that final commentary. Unless Congress comes along and changes or makes law that what is in very clear in the framework of the Constitution, my oh my, look what we have. That's what Obamacare. You know what? That's the problem with the legislature, is that they are not specific. They are not constitutionally specific. They go back to everything that we have here that, you know, I have to say was very, very insightful. That we have frantic and barbarous men are frivolously endeavoring to overturn the order established by God. What I want to leave you with is that. And I don't know, next week we're going to do a rerun because I have family coming in for my dad's 90th birthday and I'm not going to be available. But what I want to leave you with is this, is that I really believe that Sam Adams did have it right as the last Puritan, as I go through his writings. And I clearly, more clearly understand as I have read the Reformation writers and go back and am researching Calvin again. That's what you need to do. You need to understand, for us to have good government, it has to fundamentally be from that moral and virtuous positions of God's design for government. And so when we come back in 2 weeks live on the program with Samuel Adams Returns, just remember, yes, they did. The Anti-Federalists, they absolutely got it right. And we're here on Liberty Works Radio Network.